I have the poo cancer.
Which the glam cancer.
I have the glam cancer. There's nothing pink about my cancer, it's just brown.
Hello and welcome to You, Me and the Big C with Lauren Marn, aka Girl vs. Cancer, Deborah James, better known as Bowel Babe, and me, Rachel Bland, from Big C, Little Me, and you may also have heard my voice from time to time on 5 Live. We are three friends and bloggers. We've all got one thing in common. We all have cancer. And it's been kind of bugging us recently that there didn't seem to be any podcasts out there talking about what it's really like to deal with the dreaded Big C, the highs, because there are highs, as well as the lows. So here we are. You are the you in the title of this podcast. We really want you to get involved with this, get in touch with us. Any questions that you might have for us, or perhaps things that you'd like to hear us talk about in future podcasts, you can contact us across all forms of social media using the hashtag YouMeBigC. Girls, it's lovely to finally be here together.
It's fab to be here.
Look at our little cats family.
Yeah. It's the club we never wanted to join, isn't it?
The coolest club that you never want to be a part of.
You never want to be part of. I thought AA would come first for me, to be perfectly honest with you.
And it's so amazing that we're all in the same studio together.
It's about time. I mean, it feels like I've known you forever. I mean, we've all been in this room the first time this is we've all met and been together.
We've never actually met in person before.
No.
Should point that out.
Although I feel like I maybe stalk both of you and know you really, really well.
Yeah, I mean, we know each other, with online friends.
Online friends.
For over a year.
We are social media friends. And I feel like I know you two because you both update your Instagram stories daily. I know you two better than some of my very best friends.
You're not the first person who said that to me, actually. Some people are like, I know what you have for breakfast.
My husband doesn't need to worry what I get up to. He follows me on social media now and just says, oh, did you have a good day? He's just like, I know what you've been up to. End of conversation.
But this is the bond we have as people from the cancer community. We've already got that shared experience and feel like we know each other. We're on the same page.
You're my online friends, now you're my in real life friends.
Yeah. In real life.
Oh my God,
friends.
We are actually friends. We can take the bit away from the front with friends. Stuck with me now, girls.
So, should we start off then by kind of telling everyone a bit more about ourselves and our stories? Who wants to go first with their tale of woe of being told they had the Big C?
Go on then. So, I have the poo cancer.
Which the glam cancer.
I have the glam cancer. There's nothing pink about my cancer, it's just brown. Mm-hmm. So, I'm 36 years old. I was diagnosed just over a year ago, just before Christmas. Nothing like a Christmas present. To be told that after 6 months of a change of bowel habits, basically where I was pooing blood. I'm going to be very frank because I think one of the biggest problems is that people are not frank enough about the symptoms that led to their diagnosis. And then as a result, it holds up their diagnosis. So I was pooing blood and eventually got diagnosed with a 6.5 centimetre tumour up my bum, basically. And, you know, I joke about it, but when it happened, the room fell silent. I was kind of there for a camera, you know, up my backside to be rest, you know, to be told that everything was fine.
Yeah, that's what you always expect. Yeah.
You're always expecting,
it's going to be fine.
It'll be fine. And me and Lauren were talking about this the other day, that actually I'm somebody who has a history of health paranoia.
Yeah.
So you go through these cycles of saying, I'm just going to go and get myself checked out. You know, it's nothing.
Yeah.
I was 35 at the time. I'm working out. I'm tired because I'm a mum of two. Of course I'm tired. Everybody's tired. Yeah. And then suddenly the world changes. And
it literally falls out your arse, Deb, doesn't it?
Literally falls out your bum.
Falls out your bum.
Falls out your bum. For me, it came flowing. Absolutely. On a regular basis.
Yeah. And so I was similar to you, that I always had really bad health anxiety. I've diagnosed myself with all other forms of cancer. Yet when it came to the actual time when I did have cancer, I was completely and utterly oblivious to it.
It's so funny. So I Googled everything. You mean Dr. Google?
Yeah.
He's our best friend.
Worst enemy,
best friend.
Yeah.
So I Googled everything and still, besides all my symptoms, it did not come up with bowel cancer at the age of 35, because the reality is I don't fit the criteria.
Yeah.
And this is something that I know we'll touch on, but I don't look like somebody who apparently has bowel cancer.
Yeah.
And then, you know, unfortunately I was diagnosed, I had the 6.5 centimetre tumour. And then since then I'm, you know, still on treatment, had chemotherapy on Friday. So just a few days ago, and I've had over a year of kind of everything from chemotherapy to a couple of surgeries. I have stage 4 cancer. Yeah. That doesn't mean I'm going to die. I pray I'm not. My statistics, I'm just going to throw them out there, are hideous, to be perfectly honest with you. Less than 1 in 10 people survive what I have for more than 5 years. So I know what I'm faced against, but I'm currently living through my diagnosis, as we all are, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I feel like you're brave. You looked at the stats. I don't even look at the stats because I feel like I don't want to know that, because none of us are a statistic. That's the thing. All of those numbers, they just don't have any bearing on what's happening with your cancer and what your outcome is going to be. So I prefer not to know them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had that when I had my oncology meeting after I'd finished all chemo and stuff like that, my first big one. I sat there and I went, what's my percentage chance of recurrence? Because I've got the clear last year, but actually, like, with a cancer patient, you never actually feel clear, do you? So I was like, what's my percentage? And then they went to tell me, and I went, no, don't tell me.
Yeah.
All I need to know is my reality right now. And right now I'm clear. So I'm living that life.
And so you were breast cancer.
I was breast cancer, yeah. So I was diagnosed in the August of 2016. I just found a lump. I'm small chested and it was a big lump and I found it. And there was like no doubt about it. There was a lump there that wasn't there before. And it seemed to just come overnight. But again, we said, like, putting all the symptoms down to lifestyle choices. Like, I was a massive party girl before I got poorly. I was out on the scene. I was always doing something, running around town fancy free. So when I was tired a lot and a bit anxious almost in my own body, I didn't really put that. I thought I was sketchy. I was sketchy because I was hungover all the time or tired. I went to my doctor. Actually, I didn't. That's a lie. I went to a walk-in centre initially because I just moved house. And I couldn't register the GP. So I was like, I'm just going to go and get this lump checked out. It's been there for a month. I made my friend feel it, the lump in a tent. Both of us.
Saturday night.
In the tent in Glastonbury. I was like, a tent in Glastonbury, really drunk. Like, have a feel of that. Is that normal?
Yeah, was that your chat up line for that
night? Basically, I was walking around the festival going, have a feel. Is that normal?
What do you reckon?
Is there any doctors here?
Is there a doctor in the house?
Yeah, you're a handsome doctor. Yeah.
Single, ready to mingle. I went to this walk-in centre. I said, look, can you just check this? Because it's not gone away. I thought, in my head, it was a cyst. He said, yeah, it's a lump, but you're young, you're healthy, you have no family history of the disease. It's probably nothing, but you must get referred by a GP. And I was like, mate, can you not just scan me right here and right now? But because he'd said those things, I might be being young and no family history, I wasn't scared of it. I was like, oh, it will be nothing then. And I went away for a month and a half. And didn't get it checked. And it's just because I'm that way inclined with a bit of health anxiety and my mum being on my case going, have you got that lump checked? That I went back to a doctor and she did the same thing though. She went, I'm not worried about it, but it's been there. Let's check you out. And same as Deb.
I
didn't expect anything when I got in that room. I didn't. I was well chilled. Just took the morning off work. The minute they ultrasounded me, that room changed.
Yeah.
And they went, right, we're going to biopsy you. And I was alone. I was unprepared. I was terrified. And I was scared more of the procedure, actually, at that point, than I was of the outcome of the diagnosis. But when I went back into the consultant's room and she'd said, OK, so there's something suspicious. If it's cancer, we'll do this, this and this. And I was like, hang on, mate. Sorry.
And went, you just said cancer?
Yeah. Did you just say the C word?
Did you just drop the C word?
And I was like, well, what if it's not? And she went, well, have you had a trauma to the breast? Now, there's nothing to be traumatised about these boobs. They're barely there. So I really didn't expect it. When I left the consultant's room, in the back of my head, I knew, but it was still a massive shock.
Yeah.
Like,
now, I'm the same as you. I'm breast cancer. And I found a lump. I had pain first, which...
That's unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, we're talking myths later on. That is a myth. My sister-in-law said to me, you've got pain. Okay. It won't be breast cancer because it's not painful.
Cancer doesn't hurt, apparently, ladies.
Yeah.
I have the myth that breast cancer isn't...
And so I had this weird soreness that was kind of, it wasn't even in my breast, it was kind of under my arm to the side of it. And I just thought, I'd not long finished breastfeeding my little boy, and I thought it's probably related to that. Anyway,
it's still something.
And it went away after a couple of days, but because of that, I was having a bit of a feel, and I was laying flat in bed, and just felt, you know, my lump was kind of like 2-3 centimeters. Mm. So when I found it, I was like, how have I missed this? It felt like there was a walnut in my breast, and it was really, really obvious. And I was just so annoyed with myself. But still, I was like you. I was like, it's a cyst. So I went to the doctor. Yeah. She did the whole same thing. You know, 9 times out of 10, when we refer somebody to the breast clinic, you know, it's benign. So try not to worry too much. But we went and we arrived with a big bag full of sandwiches, me and my husband, because they said, oh, it'll be about 3 hours you'll be there. Magazines, you know, sat in for the long haul, all jolly. And then after the first ultrasound scan, that was when everything changed, the mood changed. We got taken to the private waiting room. They were like, we won't put you back in the main waiting room with everyone. And we just looked at each other. Right,
you know, we were talking earlier about how you now know the signs to look for. I was asked, do you have someone with you? And I know if I'm ever asked, do you have someone with you? It's bad news.
Bad news.
I've already prepared myself.
The nurse said to me, my results, they just turned up. I was like, will it be much longer? And she said, oh no, she went, you shouldn't be. The thing is, like, towards the end of the day, the wait can be longer because unfortunately the consultant has to tell people bad news. And the wait got longer. I was still there. And I was like, Mum, and she was like, no. Oh, yeah, I was getting the bad news.
But somebody, you're never quite sure, I think, with consultants, when there's a wait. If there's a long wait, is it because you don't matter and your news is fine?
It's easy.
Or are they waiting because you need the top consultant to come and give you the bad news?
And did they tell you straight away, Rachel, that you had...
Well, they told me on that day that... so they took a biopsy and they were going to send that off. So that needed to come back to confirm everything. But they were like, we are 90% sure, you know, the way that it's showing up on the ultrasound scan, we are more than 90% sure that you've got cancer. I basically left that day knowing that I had cancer and having to return to have it confirmed and what type.
Just out of interest, because I was saying that the thing that I did as soon as you know, somebody says to you, you have cancer, you go into a world that's a dreamlike state.
Don't you feel like the ground just drops away from you? Like literally that feeling of falling almost. I felt that way.
It's just you don't exist really, do you? Yeah. You're just floating along. Yeah. And then I went and got very, very drunk.
Yes, same.
No, because you're having treatment at the Royal Marsden in London.
I am,
which is very handily placed for
loads
of bars.
Loads of bars. So we drove, me and my husband, we were together, and we drove and we actually went to a local off licence. We bought the most expensive bottle of wine that we could possibly found. Necked that one, then necked another one. And then you wake up thinking, that was a really rubbish dream. You know, it's just a dream. Come on. And then you wake up and realise that you've got a really stonking hangover and it's not a dream.
Yeah. My reaction was slightly different. I didn't get that kind of dropping away thing because we'd been there all afternoon. It was like 3 hours at the breast clinic, all of these invasive tests. And then by the time they were telling me that I did have cancer, I think I was so mentally exhausted that I just started switching off. And it was November time, so I'm a Celebrity was on TV. Mm. And while this doctor, and she was doing it in her best, like, this is terribly bad news. I've head on the side, sad face, pausing for me to cry at the opportune moments, which I don't want to cry.
Just go numb, don't
you? All I was thinking was, I want to go home, I want to have some nice food, a nice glass of wine, watch I'm a Celebrity and just forget that this is happening. And then I had that same thing as you, that you wake up the next day, and for about 2 weeks I was like, oh, I just want to get through these next 2 weeks where it's not new news. It's not, so you don't wake up every morning thinking, hang on, what's, there's something wrong, there's something wrong, oh yes, I've got cancer. Because after a couple of weeks you get out of that.
I was waking up in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, kind of pinching myself, do I have cancer? Still got cancer. And it's almost like you can't believe it for a while.
That's what happened. Like, when I got taken into the room and I was like told, my donor's Lauren, sorry, it's not good news, it's breast cancer. I dropped the F-bomb a lot. I went Danny Dyer mode, full on. And my mum was like, can you stop swearing? I was like, I've got cancer, I can do what I like, actually, Mum. And it was that moment of just pure shock. And I actually said, I can't have breast cancer, I don't have boobs. And she looked at me a bit odd. And I was like, really serious? But then my first question was, I was like, I don't want to die.
Wait, I said that, I screamed at the consultant. I don't want to die. He was like, well, hold on. We can just maybe cut it out and move on. And I was like, I don't want to die.
I was too scared to mention the death word. I was just like, nobody talk about dying. I don't want to know stats. Don't tell me it's bad. This is fine. We'll cut it out. We'll move on. It'll all be okay.
My consultant was like that though. Like, I feel really grateful. Like, my instant reaction was I was terrified. Like, because in my life, I only know a couple of people that have had cancer and moved on from it. And the thing is, people have cancer and move on and don't really talk about their cancer because they've moved on.
They've moved on from it.
So all I've really known are the bad times and the people, unfortunately, that they have passed away from this horrible disease. And so for me, that was the
starting point. For you.
And because of my health anxiety as well, I catastrophize things. And the worst thing outcome will always be to die. Yeah. So that was my first thing. And the minute the consultant went to me, that's not going to happen. This is an inconvenience. Yeah. I was like, oh, is that what cancer is?
I think you've hit something totally in the head in terms of, for me, I always had this image of cancer equating to you are going to die.
Yes.
They were one of the same thing. And I think as soon as therefore somebody said to me, you have cancer, I immediately went, oh, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
And you, like, unfortunately, I do know, you know, relatives who have passed away from cancer, and it's the images that have that's portrayed of cancer. You instantly jump to the grey, dark image.
That's the very sick-looking person.
Yeah. The sick-looking bald person in the corner.
Yeah,
absolutely.
On their deathbed. What about telling other people? So that moment, you know, you get used to that moment.
Horrible.
You get used to it yourself.
How quickly did you tell other people? They look like they're going to die, don't they?
How quickly did you tell people?
Well, I share a lot, which is no surprise considering social media and stuff like that. But I share quite a lot. I find it quite easy to be open. And a lot of my close friends and stuff knew that I was going back for results that day. So when they hadn't actually heard back from me, my appointment was at 3:30. I didn't get out of the hospital till 6. People messaging me, and I just went, it's not good news. And then I had to get my brother and my mum, who I was with, to tell people. But I got everyone to the pub next to the hospital and got everyone there. And
so
then
one by one,
people started to tell other people for me. But I found it became a coping mechanism. I would just tell people as soon as I met them.
I'm like,
how are you? I'm fine, actually. I've been diagnosed with breast cancer, because it was occupying my head. Yeah, I don't know if any of you guys did the same.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I did something different with kids, and I don't know whether you had this situation.
Yeah, see, my little boy is he was only sort of one and a bit, so he's still too young to really comprehend, so I've not had to worry about that.
So me and my husband, when we thought I had cancer, because it wasn't actually until it was got, you know, the tumour had been cut out that it was 100%. They knew 90% certainty that I had it, but until that tumour was removed, it wasn't 100% certain. But we basically swallowed everything, you know, as parents do.
Yeah.
You kind of put, you've just been given the most devastating news. You then kind of, you know, wipe your tears away, walk into the house, darling, hi. You know, and your children are like, mummy, you know, my poo's funny today, or mummy, I need this for the school play, a donkey outfit, or whatever it is. And I need to make an egg princess castle, or I don't know, whatever it is that they're asking. And you just go, okay, darling, gulping your wine. Okay, darling. And you just kind of pretend everything's okay. And that's how we chose not to tell anyone, just until we got our head around
while you
to start
processed
with.
It. Yeah, see, I think I started telling people pretty soon afterwards. I was the same as you, Lolly, that I had friends that were kind of waiting for news that knew that I was going for these tests. So I think I kind of emailed a lot of close friends and were just like, tell other people. Because I found at the start, I'd be fine. Mm-hmm. And then if I had to tell someone, then I'd cry. And it's quite often managing that other person's reaction to your cancer.
It's really bad.
Where you have you have to comfort the other person.
Even to this day, I will never forget the looks on other people's faces when they found out that I was ill.
Yep.
That's what scared me. Wasn't what I was actually going through. It was people looking at me as a reflection of what was actually happening to me. I've got this mentality like, nah, not happening, crack on, let's get this over with. When actually, even to this day, I don't think I've accepted how actually ill I've been. And so that was really actually quite hard. I'll be really upfront about it, but I wasn't really prepared for that look.
Yeah.
The look.
There is a look, but there's also, I had quite a lot of people crying on me.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I can't deal with my own tears, let alone yours, love.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult to kind of sit there and go, it will all be fine.
Yeah.
I'm the one with the, you know, the cancer here. It will all be fine, love.
It's funny, isn't it, how someone else's tears kind of switch off yours.
Yeah. Yeah.
The number of times I found myself reaching out and patting somebody on the hand like, it'll be okay.
It'll be fine.
It'll be all right. I don't know that it will be.
Yeah, well, two of my work colleagues actually still laugh about it to this day, because they were the first people to know, because I'd left work to go and get my results, and I was like, I'm a bit nervous, and they were like, it'll be nothing. So when I told them it was, and they're with me every day and they know, like, me inside out, I know it was a massive shock to them. And when I came in after the weekend, I found out on a Friday, I think, and when I came back into work to meet my boss, my two work colleagues walked in the room, they were waiting for me, and I just went, both of them, can you stop looking at me like I'm going to die, please? And they were like, oh, sorry, are we? I was very like, stop it now, enough. I don't do it.
I had a situation, so I was working as a deputy head teacher in a secondary school, and because I knew that I was going off for an operation, I chose to be very public about it, because let's face it, kids are not stupid.
No.
You don't just disappear overnight for no apparent reason. So I went... I knew what my diagnosis might be. I went back into work and I told 1,000 pupils and 200 staff.
In an assembly?
Pretty much an assembly. I said, look, this is my situation. I've got a tumour, but I'll be back in about 4 weeks. Don't you worry about it. It will all be fine. And I got amazing. That was when I kind of went very public about it. And I did get amazing support. But I did find it quite emotional, actually, because people were kind of going, oh, miss, you'll be okay. Please don't die. And I'm thinking, I'll try. I don't want to cry right now in front of everyone. This is really bad. But yeah, I would say it did help me finally, you know, putting it out there. But I would then say actually managing the response of that was quite difficult. And I found it, honestly, I found it very emotionally draining.
Yeah.
And really tiring, but in a lovely way. I know people were being, you know, they just wanted to know if I was okay.
Yeah.
But it was really tiring coping with how you update people,
where
you are in the process. Yeah. And that's why I started writing a blog.
Yeah. That was exactly the same reasoning for me. So I found, you know, after we'd sort of told close friends and kind of processed it for a few weeks, you know, I put something on Facebook, I put something on Twitter, because I thought, I just want to be really open about it. I don't want to be in that position of people kind of looking at me thinking,
Something's not right. Acting a bit weird today. Owning your own diagnosis, owning your own view of this disease, because we have one forced on us, right?
Yeah.
So it's actually owning it yourself.
And so once I did go public with it, I found, like you say, you get an overwhelming response from people. And it's so lovely, you know, to everybody that sent me a message, don't think that you did the wrong thing, because, to feel that you've got that support is amazing.
Yep,
but then it is really emotionally exhausting, because I always feel like I want to reply to everyone. Yeah. I don't just want to write a stock reply and cut and paste.
Yeah.
I want to sort of answer everything that people have asked. And you do, even now, I'll sort of, and this is why I'm very slow to reply to messages, everybody. I'll sort of wait kind of a week or 2 weeks, and messages build up on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and from friends. And I'll be like, right, I'll sit down on a Sunday afternoon and type out all of my replies and like give them some time to kind of,
I don't know about you, but I mean this in the nicest way, but people wanted to see me, to see if I was okay.
Yeah.
But then I went through kind of almost a month period where I was having coffee 3 times a day and repeating my story. I could have almost recorded it.
Yeah.
And everybody wanted to know, you know, what my treatment was, what my outlook was, you know, how I was feeling, you know, did the kids know, et cetera, et cetera. And brilliant. Yeah. But I got to the end of the day and my husband would be like, what have you done today? And I'd be like, oh, I've just repeated my story 3 times and I'm knackered.
Yeah. And you start to bore yourself.
You start to bore yourself, and
you almost like go, yeah, it's this. You get flippant with it. Yeah. Because you're just like, I've said this about 5 times today already.
And I ended up then gravitating towards people who would be like, oh, how's that cancer thing going? By the way, my Tinder date last night was brilliant.
That is exactly what you need. Like, I didn't actually talk about mine, like in terms of social media and stuff in public, until I was just about to start chemotherapy. It was Stand Up To Cancer Month, actually, that I started talking about it, because I feel like when I found out I was ill, I went through what I can describe as bereavement for that whole 2 weeks. I slept in my mum's bed every night. I'd wake up in the morning and go, yeah, cancer's still here. Like it was like another world. And because I didn't know where my head was at, I knew I would be open about it because that's my nature, but I just didn't know when I was ready for that, because I knew it would come.
Yeah.
But my little brother was epic. Like, one thing I will say with a cancer diagnosis is use the army you've got around you and the people to support you. So he became my fielder off of anything. So I put on my WhatsApp, I was like, this is my brother's number. If you've got any questions, ask Ryan.
Ask him. You need somebody batting things
and he
away.
Did it. He updated all my friends so that I had the headspace to process, because it is a full-time job.
It's a full-time job. Having
cancer is full-time.
We talked about this earlier, that cancer is just a full-time job. The appointments, you know, the treatments, everything that you have to do, and then fielding all of your social media and all of your worried friends and family. It takes up a lot of time.
It can be really emotionally draining. What are you doing today? Well, I'm just going to try and live.
Yeah.
Just got number a bit of chemo. One aim for the day.
Just a bit of chemo.
Casual chemo.
100 injections.
Yeah. Let's just tell everyone where we all are, because we're all in kind of different stages of cancer treatment.
Yeah.
So where are we all now? Lolly, you're done. I'm doing that with inverted commas.
Yeah, so I got the all clear in May of last year. So really, obviously, over the moon about that. I had 8 chemotherapies. So I had one, I had four rounds of a drug called EC, which is quite hardcore. That's where
the Red Devil.
The Red Devil, baby.
Horrible poison.
Horrible poison. That sent my mind, like I was so cloudy for that whole time. And then I got put onto Doxotaxel, which is quite a harsh chemo. Like I call it the Domestos one because it's just no frills, wipes that everything away. And I had it with a couple of antibody drugs because my type of breast cancer is hormone positive, but also it's positive for a protein called HER2. Again, every cancer is different.
Yep.
So many different variations. Like
this
me and Rachel don't
me.
Have the yeah. same cancer.
So mine is very different. We'll move on in a minute.
But they're both breast. So I had that. So I had chemo, 8 rounds. Then I had surgery, which was a lumpectomy because it had shrunk down and disappeared. I was very lucky. It wasn't in the lymphs anymore. They got.
Did you have what they call a complete pathological?
I had a complete pathological response.
Amazing. Oh, I'm so jealous. I so wanted that.
I know. And this is the thing now. When I talk about cancer, I almost feel like a fraud because I'm like, oh, but it doesn't just go away because now I've had radiotherapy and I had surgery, but because my cancer's hormonal, I have just finished injections called Herceptin and they block the protein that my cancer was feeding off. But then I also have to have ongoing hormonal treatment. So I'm now infertile at 32 and I'm put into medical menopause as of tomorrow. And that will last for 5 years. So as much as my cancer's gone,
it's affecting your life forever.
It's not like it's fixed, tick, move on.
And it's the scans, it's this. I'll have to have bone density scans because I'm about to dry up and get all like... Bleh. So yeah, it's that... I feel like that part's over, but there's still different stuff.
Yeah, you're starting a new aspect.
Yes, that's where I'm at the moment. About to start menopause, ladies.
Excellent. Great place to be. Woo-hoo! I can tell you from a point of experience. Yeah. Look forward to the hot flushes.
I know.
They're driving mad. Deborah, where are you?
Where am I? So people joke with me when I say, they ask me, how long are you going to be on chemo for? And I kind of flippantly say, probably for the rest of my life. And I mean that actually, not because I am going to be 100% on chemo for the rest of my life, but I have systematic cancer. I have stage 4 cancer. Basically, it started in my bowel and it travelled to my lungs. So in terms of treatment, I have had a bowel resection, which is essentially your bowel is like a drain pipe and they've chopped a bit out.
Yeah.
And with me, stuck it back together, which is fine. It does mean that things go through it very quickly now. So I have a whole
new, better.
I have a baby's bum.
Version. Yeah.
Where things just slide right through. So I have new challenges to deal with that. So I've had a bowel resection. Then what happened is my cancer travelled quite quickly to my lungs. So I have some pesky lung tumours, if you want to say that. And 2 months after my bowel resection, I was thinking, you know, I'm a girl that likes a good plan. Mm-hmm. And the plan of action was, you know, get the tumour out of my bowel, have some chemo, go on your merry way. And unfortunately, I was then told, I had that moment when it was, no, sorry, it is in your lungs. And so I'd just undergone this major bowel resection and then I had to undergo a lung resection, which is actually really painful.
What does that involve?
Yeah, so the lung resection was actually more painful than chopping out your bowel. They basically had to slice open my ribs. I have a beautiful scar that I now get out.
Yeah, you get out all the time.
Get it out quite often. I'm now quite proud of it. It's all right. It's kind of like, look how hardcore
war wounds.
They broke my ribs for this one, by a lovely surgeon. And he cracked open my ribs, cut out basically little wedges of my lungs where the tumours were, and you know, rendered my right lung tumour free at that point in time, which was amazing. I still to this day have tumours in my left lung. I've got an operation coming up.
So is that the same operation?
No, this time I'm having a new technique, which is ablation, which is essentially where they stick a needle through your lungs and burn it out. And that will hopefully get rid of some of the remaining tumours. I've had 21 cycles of chemotherapy over the last year.
Hardcore.
Yeah.
And that's been almost continuous.
Almost continuous.
What's your cycle?
So my cycle's 2 weeks. Yeah. So if you think of 52 weeks in the year, a full cycle every 2 weeks would be 24. But 24, can't even do my maths today.
Yes, brain, everyone.
I was a deputy head teacher. Maths was not my subject. can I just say that? But in terms of, chemo brain is another thing we can talk about. But essentially, the only gap I had in my treatment was for a lung resection. And then the famous words are one step at a time.
Yeah.
I think in my situation, so best case scenario is I've got a couple of operations to get out the remaining tumours. And then
It's the dreaded scan.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The old scan anxiety.
The old scan anxiety. And then we'll see what happens. You know, I have gone from somebody who wants to know exactly what happens to somebody who is learning to be a little less of a control freak.
Yeah, it's got to be that. See, I'm just like fingers in the ears. La, 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 la. Just don't tell me. Yeah. Don't tell me anything bad. Don't look at me like you feel sorry for me. Just be normal. Be, you know, straightforward. I like surgeons that have that kind of, an oncologist that just have a real scientific demeanour, I'll call it.
But it makes you normalising it, really,
absolutely.
Isn't it?
Absolutely. Because, Rachel, you've just had an operation, haven't you?
Yeah, so I had an operation, where are we now? A week yesterday. So I'll try and be brief about my treatment because it's so complicated. When I was told I had that cancer in November of last year, 2016, I was kind of like, right, okay, get through the chemo, get through a lumpectomy and a node clearance, then probably some radiotherapy, then we're done. I was like, get to August. Mm-hmm. Of course, it didn't turn out like that. I had all of those things done after having my lumpectomy in May. Another tumour grew in the same breast in the 2 months between that lumpectomy and having my next scan.
It's like that game of splat. Yeah. It's like you want to splat them before they pop up again.
Yes.
And it was quite an enormous tumour. It was a 10 centimetre tumour.
Whoa, wow.
Yeah, there was some argument.
Did you feel it? Did you find it yourself?
No, again, see, I'm not good at telling what's going on
in my body.
This is
what I worry about, because obviously your breast becomes inflamed from the surgeries and from the radio. So you just, I would have put that down to it's just healing.
Yeah, I thought it was post-operative change. And even I had an ultrasound on it, and the radiographer that did that said, oh, no, it doesn't look like cancer to me. It looks, and it was a 10 centimetre tumour. And he said, no, it just looks like, you know, have you had radiotherapy yet? And I was like, no. He said, oh, it just looks like a few sort of post-operative changes. Anyway, so that turned up. So at that, I had a mastectomy in July, took all that away.
Have you got both off or one?
Just one. And so I didn't have, because I had to have quite a, not a radical mastectomy, but they had to take away quite a lot of tissue for that size of tumour. So I couldn't have an immediate reconstruction. Yeah. So I wear a prosthesis now. And then they still didn't get a clear margin from that. And a margin is this area of clear tissue around the tumour that they want to see. So I had another, what they call a re-excision of the scar in the August. So I'd already was told the first day that I went back to the hairdressers after chemo. So it was my first hair appointment in like 8 months. The oncologist called me while I was in the hairdresser's chair to say, oh, yeah, I've got your results back. And, you know, with this tumour, I think you're going to have more chemo. I'm really sorry. So we've kind of moved on.
Your heart sinks, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I thought I'd come to the end of something and it all started again. And you just think, you feel cheated.
Yeah.
It's like you've run a marathon and somebody moved the goalpost.
Yeah. Well, that's the keep shifting. So I knew that I was going to have more chemo. Just as I started that next chemo, my results came through from another CT scan that showed that the cancer had moved into the lymph nodes on the opposite side of my chest. So underneath my opposite armpit, which is a really weird place for them to go.
Yeah.
It's not a normal place for them to metastasize to. So there's kind of disagreement about whether they've gone there as part of an altered lymphatic drainage system. Anyway,
unique.
The number of times I've seen an oncologist or a surgeon who's like, oh, this is really unusual. And I'm just like, in cancer terms, you never want to be unusual. You just want to be run-of-the-mill, boring, standard, straightforward. So anyway, so they turned up. So they're like, right, well, chemotherapy is definitely the right thing. Have your chemotherapy. So I've just had another, what is called an auxiliary node clearance. So all of the lymph nodes taken out from under my left arm. And then I'm waiting for the results of that.
We live by scans.
You're only as good as your last scan.
That's the thing. You are only as good as your last scan. You're like waiting. And almost, do you get that thing like, can you just scan me all the time every week, please? Just so I know what's going on.
I would do that. If there was an option to implant something in my body that continuously monitored.
Some sort of alarm system.
I would take that anytime.
Yeah, because the whole scan anxiety. So I'll be due. I hope I'll be due a full body scan, because I could just do with a clear one, you know.
Yeah.
But it's that whole going for the scan, waiting for the results.
You just don't trust your body, do you?
No.
Cheated me. You defied me once. You can't do it again.
You crept up on me.
Yeah. It's almost like you want to believe your body's gonna be like do its job, but at the same time, it's sneaky. So it's that weird relationship you start having with your body afterwards, isn't it? Like, I don't quite trust this.
I don't trust what you're telling me, and obviously my body just does not tell me what is going on because I am oblivious. It's the fingers in the ears and the la la la. So we've kind of talked about a bit about why we all decided to share. I know you and your lung tumours.
If I start coughing, my guts as long as I don't stop pooing at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. Don't mess the studio.
We're okay.
Every time I cough, it's like I just blame my lung tumours. Everyone's like, you're right. And the worst thing is that I start coughing in public and somebody's like, oh, you really need to get that checked. And you know when you get this anger inside of you, it's like, I have stage 4 cancer. I have lung tumours. That is why I cough.
You have to say to them, it's cancer. cancer.
Yeah, you should.
It's when you're
like,
coughing.
Like, cancer, so.
Everyone moves away from me. They're like, oh, yeah. Like, you're infectious. And I'm like, no. You're more dangerous to me.
Yeah, exactly. Back away.
So we talked a bit about kind of how we told people and deciding to go public with this. But we all set up our own blogs, didn't we, to kind of share the story more widely. Why did you decide to do that, Lauren?
I think for me, the minute I was diagnosed, I was handed a leaflet. And on that leaflet was a woman in a really, really rubbish headscarf and a really rubbish sofa. And I was like, that, my friend, is not me. I am not doing that. That is not me. And I did feel that strength from within, that resilience, like, nah, that's not happening. And the more I kind of looked into, like, you get with breast cancer, you get put into Facebook breast cancer groups and you get put into these online forums and you're looking for reassurance, aren't you?
Yeah.
Because this is very new and you can't go to your friends really because they've not been through it. So they don't
know. No, thank God they haven't been through it.
Yeah, thank God.
Absolutely. But
they can't advise you, can they? So you go to these online communities and actually what happens is you see a lot of what you're not prepared to see. Yeah. You've not started treatment yet. You're seeing side effects you didn't even know existed. Yeah. You're seeing outcomes you don't want to even fathom because you just need to get through each step at a time. And what it did was quite negative to my mental health. So I started talking about my cancer because I wanted to control how I was perceived as a cancer patient. I didn't want to show me like hooked up really like sad on a drip in like to the chemo machine. I wanted to show it in a really like through my eyes, the way I am in terms of social media, really like curated anyway, an almost beautiful way, you know?
Yeah. Because your Instagram, you're quite a stylish person.
Oh, cheers, babes.
I'm jealous of her photos.
Your Instagram squares, your Instagram feed is beautiful. All your photos have a certain look and a certain style. Yeah. And that you've stylized your cancer really, haven't you?
That's what it is. I wanted to show it to my peer group in a different way. Because I think, again, like we run the risk of where a lot of cancers, when you go to GP, it's seen as like an advanced life stage issue. So a lot of younger people don't feel like it relates to them and actually it can be quite dangerous. They don't know what cancer actually is and they're shut off from it.
But you haven't glamorised it.
I have not glamorised it.
And I think that's quite important because I think, cancer can sometimes be glamorised and it's certainly not glamorous.
No, it's not. So my story...
It's about being real, isn't it?
Yeah. So like on Instagram, I'd show my squares quite curated, but if you followed me from the beginning on my Instagram stories, I'd be there bald-faced, bald-headed, rashy face, like... talking realistically, 3 o'clock in the morning, can't sleep from steroid-induced insomnia. Like, the behind the scenes almost of this is what it's really like. And when that started to happen, when I started to talk about it, I came up with a hashtag girl versus cancer because social media diva over here. But like,
it's a good name. I wish you got that first.
Like, yeah, that's it. I checked. I was like, no one's used this. Sweet.
Yeah, it's that moment, isn't it, when all those handles are free and you think, no way. Yeah,
why hasn't someone done this already?
Because it's waiting for me. So yeah, and when I did talk about it, the response I got on social media from that was phenomenal. And it wasn't just people going, oh, we hope you get well. It was people going through it, not just breast cancer, any cancer, people going through divorces, people going through a really hard time that found a sense of support and openness and wanted to discuss it. And that's when I decided to launch Girl Versus Cancer as its own community and blog where I could talk about it, but then other people could talk about it. Because I suddenly realised that, you know, it is billed as like this more elderly disease. Yeah. And all of the pamphlets and everything I see is aimed at that life stage. That I don't need a leaflet on how to tell my children I'm 7 years single, mate. I don't even ever want kids. When can I have a Prosecco? That's what I want to know.
You want to know if you can have sex?
Yes. Apparently, I should be having a lot of it. About to go into menopause.
You've got till tomorrow.
Yeah. But yeah, so for me, it was just really to kind of open a conversation, normalise a conversation to a younger audience and make them more aware of what's going on.
Yeah.
And not so scared of it, I guess.
Yeah.
And a bit of control as well.
And Deborah, you became Bowel Babe.
I became an alter ego that's way cooler than me.
I need a cape, Deb.
Oh, gosh, she needs everything. She is my idol.
You've even got your own cartoon graphic.
I've even got a cartoon graphic. Yeah. She's way hotter than me as well. I'm like really jealous of her,
Cow.
I think. Cow. So for me, I started my blog very much as a way of informing people how I was. So I was part of a teaching community. I just wanted to let people know how I was. But I didn't want to write under me. I find
find it, to be honest, I'm one of those people that's really vocal and then, you know, ask me to tell you that I love you to my face and I'm like, oh.
Very British about it.
Very British. Don't really want to do that. So I decided to write under an alter ego. And funny enough, Bow Babe was available on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook.
Unthinkable.
Unthinkable. I mean, you know, why somebody hadn't created this character before, I have no idea. And the reason I created her is because I felt that she was the polar opposite to somebody with bowel cancer or the perception of somebody with bowel cancer. And then I made the fatal mistake of linking it to my previous work email, which meant that when I set up my Twitter account, it sent a message to 1,000 parents to say, Bowel Babe has registered. Please follow her. And then you're thinking, oh, now I've got to do something about this. So then I just started writing and I found it really cathartic, to be honest with you. I found it was my outlet. It was the way that I could cope with telling my parents that I was okay, I could go through this, the way of normalising, I suppose, and vocalising what I was going through. And it was great. And it was also the way of me not batting people away, but when somebody's like, I need to meet with you for a coffee and I need to see how you're doing, I'd be like, oh great, have you read my blog recently? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's now got to the point where I post so much on Instagram that my mum says, I haven't seen you for a couple of days on Instagram, are you alive? And I'm like, mum, you could just pick up the phone, you don't have to just follow my life through Instagram. But yeah, it kind of it started as for me, and then it led to a point where obviously now I write a column. And I feel I have an amazing platform, I think we all do, to write about things. I don't think I write about anything that's unique. I feel that I'm writing about stuff that everybody, you know, in my situation is experiencing, but we just have a great platform to do that.
I think it's a tone of voice as well. I think it's talking a language to people, like speaking on a level, like not medical terms and clinical
it's
things.
It's just making it real, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I was kind of the same as you, really, that I started off my blog in the hopes of not repeating myself over and over, because I thought it's just an easy way of letting everybody know where I am. And like I said, I wanted to be open and for people to know exactly what was going on. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to feel like I had to hide things away.
Yeah.
And then the more that I wrote it and the more response I got to it from people saying, oh, other people with cancer saying, oh, I could have written that exact same blog. Yeah. You know, you've spoken to me. That's exactly the same way that I am feeling, that I realised that it was something that could help other people. So now I kind of try and write it in a way as if I'm writing to that, you know, frightened me that has just been diagnosed with cancer to say, you know, it'll be all right. You'll get there. And, you know, this is what it's like having it. It's not as bad as you think it will be at the beginning.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said, even in the worst situations, if you're knee deep in the trenches. If you're knee deep in the trenches with somebody else, it's not quite as bad. So,
if you've got mates there with you going through the same thing, then it feels all right. Because it's that feeling of isolation at the beginning, isn't it? That you're kind of like, you know, I was 38 when I was diagnosed. 37? I forget now. It's been such
go
a long time. Yeah, 37. And I felt like, you know, there's no one else of my age who's going through this same thing. You know, everybody else sat in the waiting room of the hospital where I was, and everybody was, you know, grey-haired in their 70s.
I'd get
80s.
Looks. Did you get looks? Because I'd
get
looks.
Oh, the looks of pity.
Well, like, isn't she young? Like, you know, just people double take. Like, is it her or her mum's been treated? It was like that. Yeah.
So I think one of the driving factors for me was a lot of people would say to me, well, you don't look like you have cancer.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, what the hell does cancer look like
but
then?
That's what we see in the media, mate, isn't it? Yeah. Like, it's a portrayal of, well, that. At the end of the day, charities want your money and they've got to make you a bit scared to give it over.
And it works.
It does.
You know, and fair play, it works. But I think if you're sitting there at 8 o'clock on a Saturday evening and you've got an advert that pops up and it's all grey and depressing and your kids are sitting next to you and you've just been diagnosed with cancer,
the sad music and the weeping comes on
and you're thinking, oh, sorry, kids. Yeah, mummy does have cancer too.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's an image not that helpful. I think all of us feel quite strongly that actually there are lows.
Yeah.
But, you know,
I love
we're living
with it. So have you seen them? Like, I forget what charity it is, but it's like a lover with cancer is still a lover. A friend with cancer is still a friend. It's like that. I love that portrayal now.
It's better. It's, yeah. At least it's less grey, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it is what it is. Like, cancer's cancer. One or two people are going to get it. It could be you. So just stop looking at it weirdly and just, you know, be a bit more open.
So we were all open about it. We all found each other through that online community. And we just got a bit of a clip of Dame Tessa Jowell to play here. She spoke in the Lords a couple of weeks ago. She is dealing with quite an aggressive brain cancer at the moment. And she gave the speech to the House of Lords where she talked about exactly this community that we're part of.
So many cancer patients collaborate and support each other every day. They create that community of love and determination that they find each other every day.
She nailed it, didn't she?
She nailed it. I
fell to bits. It just really touched. I'm like, this is exactly what we're doing every day. I speak to people going through cancer treatment. I speak to you girls like every day. Yeah. Like, it is legitimately there. That is what's carrying a lot of people through.
It is. Yeah. And you want to speak to real people. Yeah. Like, you want to speak to real people about stuff that nobody tells you in a booklet that happens to you. So, for example, I go high on steroids. They give you steroids to counteract the side effects of chemo. And it means at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm doing the Macarena at my sitting room.
Yeah,
and then I can text somebody. Doesn't let you sleep. Yeah. But then it means I can text somebody, you know, from the cancer community. And somebody else is doing, you know, five Let's Go Dancing, or, you know, whatever it might be at the same time. We're all going around our sitting room.
Yeah, it's true. It's like little nuances, right? Like, my fingernails now are like ruined from chemo. They're like weak. I'm like, wish someone had told me that.
Yeah, and you get tips.
There's so many little things, aren't there? Like, you were talking about, you get this, it's neuropathy. Called neuropathy, isn't it? Peripheral neuropathy. And I've got it to a very small degree in the tips of my fingers. You lose the nerve sensation, don't you? And that's something that you've suffered from as well.
Yeah, and you just want to, you need a bit of reassurance that isn't necessarily medical reassurance, but it's kind of, oh, mate, you know, you're as sweaty as I am right now.
Yeah. We talk about this as well, like, because you lose your nose hairs, that all of a sudden it's just a free running train. The amount of times during chemo, I'll get out of bed and just snot would just fall on the floor. And I'll be like, okay, so this is me now, cool, sexy.
And these are the things that they're not in.
And
those
no one tells you.
No one tells you that.
Now, what kind of people have you come into contact with? You know, we've got the three of us here today, but there are kind of, you know, a much wider group of women and men as well who are kind of doing the same thing as us, blogging, that everybody has kind of, you know, become friends together.
Yeah, absolutely. I think wide variety of people, but I think the one thing that they're passionate about is raising awareness.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that I feel really strongly about in terms of, you know, let's face it, the way that, you know, we're going to find better treatments and prolong lives for longer is through raising awareness about, you know, the diagnostic stage or whatever it might be. But I've met people from all walks of life, some of whom won't tell anybody about their cancer diagnosis, some of whom want to shout it from the rooftops. And I think that's the key thing, is whatever's right for you. You have to kind of roll with it. I think I'm just going to not be negative here, but I think I've also come across people who maybe don't portray it in as positive light as possible. So I have come across conversations that I maybe don't want to be part of as well, and groups that maybe don't inspire me or give me hope or positivity.
Yeah, what's your kind of feelings on that about... Because we all want to be honest and open, but I'm just a bit mindful that I also at the same time don't want to terrify anybody that is reading my blog. So where do you kind of strike that line between being honest and not scaring people?
I think it's being honest and upfront, but I think as people we're all quite like positive people, and it's telling the reality of it without it being woe is me. Like, it's so... Not, I mean, you got cancer, you could be woe is me if you want to. Hands up, like, of course you can.
Have a cry.
Yeah, it's have okay. a cry. Do Even whatever. But I think cancer, because of the way it is portrayed and the way, like, and what it does to you, it can drag you down.
Yeah.
It can really drag you down. And I think it's quite a dangerous place to sit there. But I think a lot of people do. It's where they're most comfortable. Whereas that's not a comfortable place for me. So I can't be involved in those conversations, because actually what it does to my mental health and the things that he puts into my head, I'm not ready for, and I don't want to be. And I think a lot of... We'll talk about this, I know, in future, like, about perception and what cancer does to change your perceptions.
Yep.
I have to live my life with a certain mindset, so I can't be part of those conversations, because it will take from me, and then actually it may impact my health through stress or stuff like that.
Yeah, I think we're all quite similar in that we do want to kind of keep that happiness about us. We don't want to... And it's okay if you want to sit and cry because you've got cancer and be be really fed up about it because it's not good, then that is totally fine.
And it's okay to be not okay as well.
Yeah, this is something I keep saying on my blog. It's okay not to be okay. Yeah. You know, where everyone tells you, oh, be positive, be positive. It's all right not to be positive for a while.
Have you girls also encountered, this might be a bit controversial, encountered like fan girls or boys that literally... It's like they're messaging you constantly and you're a bit like, oh, I don't know what to do with you. Like I want to tell you, I want to feedback, I want to be there. But I just about have time to like make a cup of tea today. Yeah. And I'm like constantly updating. So in a way, it's like awesome because you've got this network. But at the same time, you're like, I'm only one person. I can't respond to everyone all the time.
Yeah. I think it goes down to, we were talking earlier about human interest. And if I don't update my Instagram, I get a few messages. And basically the messages are you still alive?
Yeah. I had one of these the other day and I thought, you know, I'm probably, if I am dying, you're not going to be the first person that I'm going to tell.
I'm probably not going to post on Instagram.
Funnily enough.
I've got a few others to, you know, I might get it out there before I tell you personally, and that I don't know. But yeah, there are a few of those around. At the end of each podcast, we're gonna do a top five. So this is our first top five today. And we're going to do myths about cancer because, as we've been saying, there are just so many misconceptions. And that's the whole point of You, Me and the Big C, is to try and kind of bust some of these myths about cancer. So let's put together our top five myths about cancer. Where shall we start? Who wants to fire away with one?
Now, this isn't the obvious one, but it is the obvious one for me. Mm. So when I was told I had stage 4 cancer, I didn't say, oh my word, I'm going to die. I went, I'm going to lose my hair.
My first question as well.
My first question. The myth for me about cancer is you don't always lose your hair.
No,
it depends on the drugs.
It does.
And I was very lucky that I've kept my hair so far. If I change my drugs, I might lose my hair. But the myth is not everybody with cancer has a bald head.
Yeah, it's very, very true. Like, there's people walking around with, no, sat next to you on the tube, full of head of hair, full of cancer, never know.
Well, I mean, that's like me, is that I've been to quite a lot of medical appointments where I've seen oncologists and surgeons who've looked at me and gone, have you had your chemo? I'm like, yeah, like it's not that unusual. Yeah. But I use something called a cold cap that, again, I talk a lot about online that has managed to
You've
save
done
my
really
hair.
Well You've with a cold cap.
Well, you see, I had a lot of hair to start with. Yeah. I've got fine hair, but just loads of it. So it thinned a bit in places, but... The majority of it I kept.
See, I used the cold cap as well.
Oh, did you?
But I still shed quite a lot. Like, I've talked about in the blog, and I won't talk about it too much now because I get really emotional, but when it started to, like, shed, I guess, but then I washed my hair for the first time and literally it washed off me. Mm. And it was terrifying. That moment of seeing your body, like, just crumble. Shed. But saying that, I had quite a lot of hair and I got out the shower and I just had a ball patch at the top of my head. But everything else was still there. Because the way the cold cap works, it sticks to some bits and not others, right? Yeah. So I found that throughout my treatment, I kind of balded quite a lot at the top. I call it the Freya Tuck effect. There's a massive ball patch in the middle. Everything else thinned out, but it stayed. So when I put on a scarf, you would always see me with the red lip and the headscarf in. And I felt a lot like me. So I did bald to some extent, but because I had the cold cap, I kept quite a lot of hair and also felt it was nice to be able to hide.
I feel like we should explain actually what a cold cap is because you've used it as well, haven't you, Deb? But okay, let me just try and think of a way of explaining this.
Like a jockey cap.
Yeah, so it's basically this a cap that you put on your head and it has a coolant running through it. It's like a sort of a skull cap and that coolant cools down your scalp. So it stops the chemotherapy drugs getting into the very outer layers of your hair follicles. Yeah.
Freezes your brain.
Yeah, yeah, basically. And so if you wear that for, is it something, it's half an hour cool down, then you wear it during the period that the chemotherapy drugs go in, and then between sort of 20 minutes and an hour and a half afterwards. And that, in theory, and it doesn't work for everybody, works for some people, not for others, that actually saves your hair from falling out. And for me, you know, it worked really well.
And it is painful, but it's worth it.
Yeah, it's like
I don't find it painful.
Really?
Oh, you have a couple of paracetamol half an hour before. And I feel the cold. I thought, you know, all these stories that I'd heard about it, and the first time that I put it on, I said to the nurse, like, when's it going to get cold?
Yeah.
And she's like, no, that's as cold as it gets.
Oh, you are really?
Hardcore. Yeah, you are hardcore.
I had all these techniques. I was making all these
videos.
I've seen
you've got some great videos.
It's like how to juggle through the cold cap.
Like,
how to
recite the alphabet. 5 minutes, isn't it?
It's like the first after 5 minutes, that, ten minutes, and then you can
kind of acclimatizes. Yeah.
So yeah. I was doing everything. I was literally actually juggling. I took spinning plates into the hospital.
Of course you did, Deb. Of course you did.
I took tennis balls to like bounce them against the
wall. Circus girls.
But do you know what we should have done? You know the Velcro strips.
You could have knocked them on your head.
Do it now. Because over that underneath cap, there's like basically a rugby scrum cap that goes on. It's not a good look, is it?
I rocked it, mate.
Whenever I had to unplug, if I needed to go to the loo mid chemo, and unplug from the machine that kind of cools everything down, and you just walk past people just like, hi.
I think I would have definitely braved the shave if I hadn't have had the curl pad because it like kept so much of my hair, and it was something I gave a go. If it hadn't worked for me, I'd have just stopped. But I think, you know, when you're in that position, you
give it a punt.
Why not?
I'm gonna throw in now with number two, and that is that young people don't tend to get cancer. Mm-hmm. It's something that we've touched on already.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm passionate about that subject. Yeah, for me, it is always since the day I was diagnosed. I just feel like we don't talk about this disease in an open, normal way. And as a young person, it was never even on my radar that I should be concerned about any symptoms because you're invincible. Mm. You are walking around with like Superwoman or Superman, aren't you?
And, yeah, it's never going to be you.
It's never going to be. It happens to other people, right?
Yeah.
But I think like the danger, like it does happen to young people. I mean, who has the really great stat? Was it, you, Rachel, said about how many young people get diagnosed? Is it like one? We'll find it. But like, it's a high amount of young people get diagnosed, and there's like this weak spot in the middle. I think there's like children's cancer charities and teenage cancer charities, and then there's like the other cancer charities.
Not old people, but it's catered to a more advanced life stage.
But there's different challenges for people in that in between. I'd say like your 20s to your 40s, where there's different life stages that you're at. Like, for example, you girls are all within my age bracket, but you've had kids, you've got a partner, you're married, I'm single, I have no children. So it's like my life is before was all about partying. So it's talking about it to a different audience so they can understand better because they might feel a bit neglected.
I'm not ignoring you two girls, by the way. I'm
looking for your
Googling.
Stat.
I'm looking
you're
for
Googling.
My stat. Keep talking, keep talking.
Doctor Google.
For me, the biggest thing is I have a cancer, which apparently young people don't get.
But they do.
And this is the problem. So I think also when you fall out of the age bracket that you're cancer, so the average person for me is 69 and 69-year-old bloke. Yeah. And I don't.
You are not he.
I am not he, exactly. So I think that's the problem when you don't fit the mold of your cancer, and people then kind of go, well, you're too young. And actually I'm part of a campaign for bowel cancer called the Never Too Young campaign, which is really important because, you know, 2,500 people are diagnosed every year with bowel cancer specifically under the age of 50. And yet it's deemed something that people are you know, it's an older person's disease. And yet actually that's quite a lot.
And it's true. And it's also, have you got the stat?
I have the stat. And this is direct from Cancer Research UK. So cancer, no longer the disease of the old. 1 in 10 new cancer cases diagnosed in people aged 25 to 49. There are twice as many cases in women than men in this age group. Numbers on the rise. Each year, almost 23,000 women under the age of 50 are diagnosed with cancer.
And there we go. Incredible. And this is why Girl vs Cancer. I'm like, come on, like, we've got to talk about this because I still find it crazy, right? That in our schools, we take young girls into rooms and we tell them about their periods and we show them how to put condoms on a banana. But we do not tell them how to check themselves for
their boobs.
I didn't. You know, there was me with my 3-centimetre tumour.
Yeah.
I'd had my son. I'd breastfed my son. I'd even find a bit of a lump when I was breastfeeding him that was just, you know, something and nothing. But once I'd finished breastfeeding, I put them away and just forgot about them. And I was like, oh dear, they're not in a good state. Yeah. Let's stick them in a bra and ignore them.
You just don't empower young people, you know? Like, they'd be just like to know what is normal, like, being in tune with your body is the most powerful thing you have.
I think it's part of our Britishness, and I appreciate this is probably an entirely different topic, but I find that we have a bit of a British stiff upper lip when it comes to talking taboos. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to talking about, you know, what is a normal period? What do normal boobs look like? What does normal poo look like?
Yeah,
people get
frequently discussed.
People get a little bit funny, and it's in schools as well. You know, I'm a teacher, and you know, as a teacher, I would get embarrassed talking about certain things I shouldn't do, but it's kind of how we're ingrained to be. And actually, it's about changing those taboos, isn't it?
Yeah,
because
that's
the only way that we can normalise it and get people talking.
100%.
And change the thing. I could
well, this might be a wrong statistic, but my understanding is that there was a study done, and actually there are a million mums in the UK living at today with cancer.
Do you know what? That is phenomenal. Like, yeah. To me, like, I don't have kids, but I look at you women and I'm just like, you are powerhouses, because I'm just looking after me, you know? Like, I have to get myself through this, but you have people that are your dependents and need you in life, and to go through that and have to be strong for them as well as yourself. I mean, I think it's incredible. And do you think as mums there is a lot to support young, like, mothers? Is there enough? Is there could be more?
I think there could be more. There are some groups. There are groups for breast cancer. There's the Younger Breast Cancer Network, where there's a lot of mothers on there, but there's not a great deal that's specifically targeted. As we've talked about, all the leaflets that you get, they're all, you know.
Yeah. People who are past baby making stage, yeah. You say.
I think there's different needs. So there's needs that people don't appreciate. So I know people through Instagram and stuff where, you know, how do you get to your chemo appointments when you've got triplets or you've got twins that need childcare? Yeah. You've got no one around, or you might be a single mum. Childcare's expensive. The hospitals, I do occasionally take my kids actually to demystify the whole. I have taken my daughter. She got a ring stuck on her finger. It's a bit of a long story. Yeah. It's a bit of a stupid thing. She got a ring stuck on her finger. I was in the middle of chemo. She had no choice. She had to sit there with the ring stuck on her finger while they sawed it off and I had drugs pumped into me. But that was a totally different random story. But I do think it's, you know, sometimes you can demystify things by bringing your kids in. But the reality is that it's not a place, you know, no. You don't want to sit there on chemo with your kids there. And so there's logistics, you know, with parents and families that could be supported better, I think.
Okay, number three, which of these should we go for? This is something we've kind of touched on a bit. The myth that all cancer is the same.
I've learned so much from you guys.
Yeah. There is so many, the thing is, there's so many different cancers, and each of them have their own like niches and like changes
different
and mutations
and treatments, different types of chemo, different immunotherapy.
Like, I found out that my drug I'm about to have to put me into early menopause, actually they give to prostate patients as well. So it's all this stuff that crosses over and is so complex.
You become an expert in your own field, don't you?
Do.
You suddenly, like, sometimes I think I could probably retrain to be an oncologist, but
I think that
then I read into it a bit more deeply and see a scientific paper and think,
I don't know about you, but I've become really fascinated with like different types of cancers.
It's amazing.
And like, I love talking to, like, it's rubbish that I have to talk to other people about having cancer because no one should have it. But when I do talk to them about the different parts and, oh, this happened to me, and, oh, this drug does this, and it's incredible. And I'm like really fascinated. I've such a like respect for the medicine and the new things they're finding all the time.
And I think there's lots of different cancers present different challenges.
Yes, they do.
So, you know, whether it's a hormone driven problem or a poo driven problem or whatever it might be, but there are commonalities. So I think we can all relate to kind of the emotional things. There are common symptoms that we all have to go through, but they are all very different, but you know, cancer is cancer, regardless of the stage, regardless. It's a scary word.
Well, this kind of brings us into number four, which is, I think, a pet hate of all of ours, is this myth that big pharma, I'm doing inverted commas around that, the big pharmaceutical companies are hiding the cure for cancer, that the cure for cancer has been found, but because they can't monetize it, because it's some sort of natural ingredient or something, so the myth goes, they are hiding the fact that there is a cure for cancer. And I think it's fair to say that we're all kind of not really on board with that.
No, and I just tell you what, it tends to be the people who haven't had cancer that have that point of view. And I tell you something now, when you're in a room and you get told you have cancer, you will take whatever is given to you.
Absolutely.
And I know from the bottom of my heart that I was treated with the best possible drugs they could have given me. Do both of you feel the same? Because I feel like I've done anymore.
We're both under the care of the master, and I feel it's an incredible place. And I know there's lots of incredible places around the country that are doing the best. To be perfectly honest, I think oncologists are so passionate about what they're doing. Yeah. If there was a magic cure, they would do anything to give it to us.
They would.
You know, let's face it, we're not playing with, you know, we're playing with people's lives here. We're playing with, you know, when my kids rock up, when anybody's kids rock up, you want them to stay alive. Yeah. And money, money comes into it. And we know that that's a whole different conversation. But, you know, let's face it, we're humans at the end of the day.
Yeah. I've been treated on the NHS.
NHS. So I've been treated partially at the Christie Hospital, which again is another world leader in cancer treatment, where a lot of research and so on is going on. So, you know, part of my treatment has been there and part of it in my local hospital as well. And, you know, The mere thought that all of these people working in that sector, looking after people like us and trying to keep us alive, are actually at the same time hiding a queue and going, no, I'm just going to let this mum die because we're not going to make any money out of it.
I don't have any money.
I think what people don't realise is actually the problem isn't there's the drugs aren't that the drugs are there, but the problem is it's a bit of a postcode lottery in our country, unfortunately. Like, if you're treated in certain hospitals or you're able to be treated in certain parts of the NHS, you have access to certain drugs, and that's what needs to change. Yeah. It's not that there's a big drug being hidden, it's that the costs of the drugs and the cuts that are happening are really affecting people's lives. That's the impact it's having.
I was told pre this second lot of chemo that I've had that there was a drug, and I don't remember the name of it, that might help to make the chemo more effective, but because I didn't have private healthcare, then it wasn't available on the NHS. But then I think there are some areas of the UK
where it is available. Yeah, and either way it's funded. Yeah,
I feel like at the Marsden, I had access to new antibody drugs, not chemo necessarily, but that were brand new on the market because of where I was being treated. Still NHS, but it's because of where I was,
which
is amazing, but also really angers me that not every woman should have access if it's going to help them, you know?
And it's access to certain unique treatments and stuff. Like, I know my ablation is something that's not widely available. It's just because it's only available in certain centres in the UK.
Yeah, you're just lucky.
I'm in a centre where I live in
London. When it comes to cancer, you're not lucky, but certain things that happen, you thought, I'm very fortunate.
Very fortunate in a rubbish situation.
Yeah.
Number five, let's smash this one before we go, that camphor.
Camphor. So I was saying.
Got a new word for it now?
That's a new word.
That's a new name. Brain.
Cancer is not a death sentence.
It isn't a death sentence. Like, I mean, I'm talking from one thing. I mean, I've been given the all clear. I say that with a little quote sign. But I think people realise now that, you know, you can have stage 4 cancer. That's not necessarily terminal. Stage 4, you can live with for your whole life, and you can live a good life.
And let's be clear about those two separate things. Is that stage 4? Incurable cancer is not the same as terminal cancer.
Yes.
No, it's very different.
It's a very different thing. So
I'm in a situation where my aim is to kick the can as long down the road as you possibly can until something comes up with a magic cure. But I think, you know, I'm not going to lie. I'm going to say in certain circumstances, you know, let's face it, oncologists don't beat around the bush, and they will have a very serious conversation with somebody, and they will say, you know what, you know, we've done everything that we can do. However, I don't want people coming to the table saying, I've got cancer, I'm automatically going to die, because I think you do jump to that. Yeah. But even with stage 4 cancer, yes, I've unfortunately lost people who were diagnosed at the same time as me with the same type of cancer. But then we probably all have, haven't we?
Yeah.
And we've seen that. But it's not the end of it. I have hope, to be honest with you. I think I'm a little bit more, I feel that if you don't have hope, what have you got then?
Yeah,
you take away hope from a cancer patient at your peril.
Yeah, oh my God, yeah, imagine.
That is what is going to keep you going. So those are our top five myths about cancer. We'll be doing a top five in the podcast every week. And that kind of brings us to a close today. Yeah. So, you know, thank you, girls, for being so open and honest. We've talked about poo, we've talked about bottoms, we've talked about boobs.
Yeah. Boobs.
We've got it all in about there. Boobs.
Just to reiterate, we would love you to get in touch with us. The hashtag is You, Me, Big C across all social media. We are there. Instagram,
we're
Twitter,
there.
Facebook. Use that hashtag. We'll look
share
at your
stories.
Comments.
Come on, I want to. I love hearing positive stories from people.
Yeah.
It gives me hope, actually, to be honest with you, because I love, you know, somebody saying, I was diagnosed 10 years ago, stage 4, and you know what? I'm still
favorite.
Here.
Yeah,
it's my favourite.
Yeah.
So get in contact with us
if you're that person.
please
tell us your story.
Us.
And if you're not that person, we want to hear from you as well. If you've got questions or anything like that for us, then we'll try and answer those in future podcasts. But thank you very much for listening to us blather on about cancer today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll speak to you again soon. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for downloading the You, Me and the Big C podcasts.
Don't forget to click subscribe.
Or get more great podcasts from 5Live at bbc.co.uk/podcasts.